Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, March 7th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. We'll begin with the Siouxland's five-day forecast, and today is going to be cloudy and mild with a high of 55 and a low of 27. Friday in the morning, there could be rain and it'll be breezy with a high of 46 and a low of 21. Saturday is going to be sunny and not quite as cool as Friday, with a high of 54 and a low of 24. Sunday is going to be nice and warm with a high of 67 and a low of 31. Monday will be partly sunny and warm with a high of 70 and a low of 42. Today's mini editorial is written by Henry Wood of Mobile. And Henry writes, Thomas Jefferson's remark that bad governments result from too much government was exemplified with Biden administration's new rule to reduce credit card late fees from $32 to $8. We have reached the era where bad government leads to more bad government. And again, this was written by Henry Wood of Mobile. Our first story comes from South Sioux, is expanding housing offering. With the Missouri River wrapping around South Sioux City on the north and east and Dakota City directly to the south, city planners must look west for new development options. Plan to develop land along Old Highway 20 on the southwest side of town does just that, putting more than 100 acres on the table for much-needed housing. It also includes zoning for commercial and light industrial development. We are hoping this sparks growth on the west side of town, South Sioux City Economic Development Director Oscar Gomez said of the 143-acre Old Highway 20 redevelopment area. The way South Sioux is growing, this is the area that's going to be taken over by the city. The city's Community Development Agency in February approved a study finding the Old Highway 20 redevelopment area as a blighted and substandard area. The Planning and Zoning Board and the City Council both are expected to consider similar action later this month. If approved, the door is open for negotiations with interested developers to intensify, perhaps even leading to construction yet this year. Gomez said, obviously, we want to do it as soon as possible. The redevelopment area includes some existing residences and commercial industrial properties, all of which will remain. About 60% of the land is currently undeveloped. Of the total area, 104 acres are pegged for single-family homes defined as workforce housing, with prices not to exceed $305,000. The city is in need of new housing, Gomez said, with a recent study showing the need for 800 housing units, either single-family homes or apartments. Gomez said, obviously, with housing as short as it is, we are always looking at doing something. If they can make it as affordable as possible, there is a demand for it. The push for the development area came from the Community Development Agency, a five-member board appointed by the mayor that manages the city's tax increment financing districts with the goal of creating economic development. The city owned three vacant parcels of land currently leased out for crop production north of Old Highway 20, and all of them have since been annexed into the city limits. The CDA has a purchase agreement with one developer interested in building homes and is in discussions with another developer for a separate housing development, CDA Chairman Bruce Davis said. If we could get that developed, that would be a significant development to add single-family homes, Davis said. Ideally, we could have most of that into single-family home development. Land in the development area on the south side of Old Highway 20 would be zoned for commercial and light industrial use. With the blighted and substandard area designation, the Old Highway 20 redevelopment area meets a state requirement that enables the city to create a tax increment financing, or TIF, district to provide property tax revenues the city can use to fund improvements in the area. It also allows existing businesses within the district to tap into TIF funds. for building expansions and improvements. Somewhat misleading, a blighted and substandard area is not defined as a neighborhood filled with crumbling buildings. Instead, to qualify as a blighted and substandard area, an area must meet certain criteria such as an average age of buildings within the area's boundaries of at least 40 years old, lack of amenities such as paved streets and sidewalks or other city utilities, and irregularly shaped undeveloped land tracts. Old Highway 20 redevelopment area will require construction of streets and a new sanitary sewer lift station, plus sewer lines. Some of these city utilities already extend into the area. The city also hopes to expand Old Highway 20, which is narrow and lacks shoulders, to 3 lanes all the way through city limits. Based on current interest, city leaders are optimistic that new homes will sprout up soon and fill in the area quickly. If all that was developed in the next couple of years, then I'll be dancing because that means we were successful, Davis said. Our next story is from the Sioux City Council, shelter to benefit from budget allocations. The Sioux City Council voted Wednesday during a budget wrap-up session to allocate $50,000 to neighborhood services to benefit the warming shelter. A plan for how exactly the city's only emergency shelter will be able to use the money will come back to the council sometime in the next 3 months. Options could include using the $50,000 as leverage to apply for larger grants or directing it toward utility costs. The vote was 4-1, with Mayor Bob Scott casting the lone no vote. Scott said, "You've got $50,000 on a budget that's $840,000. All you've done is put a band-aid that's not going to solve the problem. They've relied heavily upon one contributor in that organization for an awful long time, and my understanding is they've lost that contributor. So they've never had a sustainable game plan. And now you don't have a sustainable game plan. Who do you come to? The city. Always the city." At the City Council's January 22nd meeting, Shayla Moore, the Warming Shelter's executive director, asked the council to allocate funding to the shelter in the next budget year, which begins July 1st. She said the shelter's closure will become a harsh reality if additional funding cannot be secured. Currently, around 140 people are staying at the warming shelter at 910 Nebraska Street on a nightly basis. The shelter has been operating for about 11 years, primarily on donations. The nonprofit's monthly budget is around $70,000. Mayor Dan Moore said the city is at a crossroads right now, with not just the warming shelter, but homelessness in the city. Moore said, "Other than City Hall, the library, and the bus depot, there are no public restrooms and drinking fountains in the downtown area. That's not for lack of trying. We've tried that, and it didn't work very well. Cook Park is the closest, and those restrooms are often locked." Moore said city staff, the council, downtown partners, and other stakeholders need to take a hard look at their vision for downtown and addressing the needs of the city's homeless population. He continued, "I think all of the council and the mayor have, over the past decade, attended several meetings on homelessness and issues that surround that. I think a lot of those meetings have been worthwhile. But there isn't any real plan or vision of where we are headed today. I think we have to come to grips with that." Councilman Alex Waters said he believes more needs to be done to intentionally combat homelessness. He said, "But I also understand the mayor's concern that as soon as you offer or extend financing or a budget to one entity, suddenly you're creating favorites or you're singling out different organizations when others are doing just as much to really provide a public good or a public service." Waters said he met with the Warming Shelter's director and neighborhood service staff. After those discussions, he came up with 3 options to make a more sustainable impact. Options are allocate $50,000 to neighborhood services to provide additional services to the Warming Shelter, such as an intake program or direct coordination with Rapid Rehousing, so that individuals are not just endlessly going to the Warming Shelter. Provide a $50,000 line of credit to leverage toward an application for a larger grant, or develop a 5-year strategic plan to address homelessness in the community. Councilman Matthew O'Kane asked, "Do any of our internal plans include housing the homeless? If we're not offering housing, then we at least need to bolster people that are willing to take that from the city." During the meeting, the council also approved the contracting of off-duty Woodbury County Sheriff's deputies to police the city's parks rather than hiring a full-time parks enforcement officer, and greenlighted a grant writer for the city's finance department. Whether the grant writer will be a full-time city position or a contract position is yet to be determined. Council members are slated to approve the budget during their April 15th weekly meeting. We'll now move to with the Sioux City School District. School unions present contract proposals. The Sioux City Education Association, or the SCEA, and the Sioux City Education Support Personnel Association presented their opening proposals for 24-25 school year salaries Tuesday afternoon. Brenda Zahner, director of the Siouxland Uniserve Group of the Iowa State Education Association, presented the information with members of both union and district administration in attendance. The SCEA proposed a 4.5% base salary increase and a $1,500 increase in longevity pay. The percentage increase would result in a $1,742 base increase from $38,711 to $40,453. The SCESPA proposed a $2.10 an hour increase and the addition of two new longevity pay categories. 5 years would give a $50 a month increase, and 10 years would give a $100 increase. SCESPA also proposed increasing current longevity pay for 15 years from $75 to $150, for 20 years from $100 to $200, and from 25 years from $125 to $250. Under state law, the opening proposal from employee unions and the response from the district are open to the public. Subsequent bargaining sessions are held behind closed doors. The district will present its opening proposal next Wednesday. The SCEA has step increases in its contract that give a base salary increase for each additional year of service. Including that base increase, the longevity pay asks and TSS increase, documents provided by the district show a 6.55% increase from the SCEA proposal. For the SCESPA, the $2.10 increase is a 12.7% hourly increase, according to district administration. In addition to salaries, SCEA has proposed various wage changes throughout the contract, including increases to substitute pay, hourly rate for extra duties, and adding new positions to the supplemental pay schedule. Teachers who perform substitute teaching duties during their planning time currently receive $40 per class period. The union is proposing increasing it to $50. If a teacher substitutes for a half day, they currently receive $75. The union is proposing it be increased to $125. For nurses, the union proposed those who perform substitute nursing duties for an absent colleague be compensated at $125 for one half day. The union also proposes meetings be added to paid out-of-contract events, and the hourly rate be increased from $40 to $50. For extracurriculars, teachers are compensated according to a salary schedule based on the activity. Each role gets a percentage of the base salary. The SCEA is proposing adding new positions, including high school musical assistant, high school esports advisor, National Honor Society advisor, Gender Sexuality Alliance advisor, elementary academic advisor, and middle school academic advisor. The SCESPA also proposed other changes to the contract, including increases for certifications, increased emergency leave days, and changes to assistant pay. Currently, SCESPA assistants who have a para-education certification or four-year degree receive 40 cents added to their hourly salary. The union proposed increasing the pay for those with a para-educator certification to 60 cents and those with a four-year degree to 80 cents. Assistants who have an early childhood certification currently receive an additional 40 cents. The union proposed increasing it to 60 cents. Secretaries with a four-year degree currently receive an additional 40 cents, and those with a two-year degree receive an additional 60 cents. The union proposed increasing those by 80 cents and 60 cents, respectively. Currently, the union contract states assistants whose regular assignments in foundations receive a dollar $1.10 increase to their hourly rate. Zahner said the resource room paraeducators are doing the same work as the foundation assistants. The union proposed changing the language from foundations to special education. If an SCESP employee is required to monitor a classroom for longer than 30 minutes, the union proposed they receive compensation commensurate to the hourly rate of the second step of substitute pay. If there is a snow day during the year that is not made up, currently SCESPA lose a day's worth of wages. The union proposed those employees receive an additional 3 days of emergency leave in case of school cancellation due to inclement weather. Hinton School Board accepts resignations of two principals. The Hinton School Board on Tuesday night voted to accept the resignations of Phil Goldstowers as the 7th to 12th grade principal and Brian DeYoung as 4th to 6th principal and athletic director. The vote was 5-0 to accept both resignations. Because Tuesday night's meeting was a special meeting, no public comments were accepted. Hinton Superintendent Ken Slater declined to comment on the reason for the resignations. DeYoung sent the school board a terse one-letter sentence dated Monday. "Consider this my letter of resignation from all administrative duties at Hinton Community School effective June 30, 2024. Gutzenstauer's letter of resignation, written on Hinton Community School District letterhead and dated February 27, was somewhat longer, saying in part, "As of late, I find myself questioning my purpose and my desire to be principal at this time." He wrote that he was resigning at the end of the 23-24 school year. "I would like to express my gratitude to Mr. Gutzenstauer for his exceptional leadership and guidance. His efforts to create a positive and inclusive learning environment have made a great impact in a short time for our school and community. Thank you, Mr. G," Hinton School Board Kyle Hoffling said at the meeting. Hoffling also thanked DeYoung for his hard work and long service to the district. The school board also voted in favor of a $10,000 contract with the Iowa education recruitment firm of Grundmeier Leader Services to assist in the search for two new principals. Wingstop coming to Sioux City. The Wingstop chain of chicken wing restaurants is planning to open a Sioux City location this spring. A company spokesperson said in an email the restaurant will be at 1921 Hamilton Boulevard, the site of a former Cold Stone Creamery which closed in 2018. The Texas-based publicly traded Wingstop, founded in 1994, already operates more than a half a dozen locations in Iowa. The nearest locations to Sioux City are in Sioux Falls, Omaha, and Des Moines. As of December 30th, the company operated a total of 2,214 locations, including both domestic and international. Wingstop, which positions itself as the wing experts, is known primarily for its chicken offerings in flavors including Hawaiian, lemon pepper, garlic, Parmesan, Cajun, and something called Atomic, the spiciest flavor, as well as hand-cut seasoned fries made from scratch ranch dressing and brownies. Demand for their wings and chicken sandwiches has apparently been robust. Wingstop sales increased 24.5% in the fourth quarter of 2023 to $965.9 million compared to the fourth quarter a year earlier, according to the quarterly financial report issued last month. During that 13-week period, the company opened 115 locations. For the entire fiscal 2023, the company's sales were $3.5 billion, up 27.1%. Wingstop market capitalization is a whopping $10.8 billion. And another story from Hinton. Hinton Community School District voters rejected two ballot measures in a special election Tuesday. The first measure proposed giving the district the power to raise a levy to be between $2.70 and $4.05 per $1,000 of the assessed value of taxable property within the school district to pay the principal and interest on bonded indebtedness of said school corporation. The second measure focused on continuing the Hinton School's physical plant and equipment levy, not exceeding $1.34 per $1,000 for another 10 years. The yes vote for the first measure was 39.96%. It required 60% of the vote to pass. The yes vote for the second measure was 43.93%. It only needed a simple majority. A total of 489 people turned out to vote at the Hinton Community Center. Storm Lake man faces robbery charge. A Storm Lake man is in custody on suspicion of attempting to rob another man at gunpoint. The Storm Lake Police Department received a report on Sunday about an incident that had occurred a day earlier in which the victim reported being approached by a man in the 200 block of East 5th Street. The victim said the man displayed a handgun and demanded money, then fled into a nearby apartment building after learning the victim wasn't carrying any cash. On Tuesday, the Storm Lake Police Department's entry team and the Buena Vista County Sheriff's CERT team executed a search warrant at an apartment at 220 East 5th Street and located the suspect, Netapan Ludwig. During a search of the apartment, police located a BB gun pistol in Ludwig's bedroom, matching the description of the gun displayed in the robbery. Ludwig, 37, was booked into the Buena Vista County Jail on a charge of first-degree robbery, a Class B felony. His bond was set at $25,000. Thurston County Jail inmate death under investigation. West Point, Nebraska man has died in custody at the Thurston County Jail. The Nebraska State Patrol is investigating the death of Edgar Walker, 53, who had a medical emergency Monday. He was transported to Pender Community Hospital, where he was pronounced dead. The Thurston County Sheriff's Office asked the State Patrol to conduct the in-custody death investigation, according to a State Patrol news release. According to court records, Walker pleaded no contest in February to second-degree domestic assault for a January 2nd incident. He was scheduled to be sentenced on April 4th. Appeals Court upholds Dickinson County murder conviction. The Iowa Court of Appeals has affirmed the murder conviction of a Minnesota man who fatally shot his ex-girlfriend in Milford, Iowa. A jury found Christian Guiney Yarns guilty in December 2022 of first-degree murder for the shooting death of 24-year-old Shelby Wozeski. He was sentenced to life in prison without parole. He had appealed his conviction, arguing the state did not offer sufficient evidence to support a first-degree murder conviction. A three-judge panel disagreed, ruling prosecutors presented evidence that satisfied all the elements of the crime to support the conviction. The record contains substantial evidence that Gwena Yarns shot Wojcicki. The judges said in their decision. Gwena Yarns, 27, of Jackson, Minnesota, shot Wojcicki on February 3, 2022, in the parking lot at Grape Tree Medical Staffing in Milford as she arrived for work. She was shot at least twice and was able to call 911 and identify Gwena Yarns as a shooter. He was arrested about an hour and a half later. Wojcicki of Spencer, Iowa, died in a Sioux Falls hospital 3 days later. She had two young sons from a previous relationship with Gwena Yarns. The trial was moved to Dickinson County from Dickinson County to Buena Vista County after the defense was granted its change of venue request, which said media coverage and publicity surrounding the shooting and subsequent hearings would have made it hard to find an impartial jury in Dickinson County. Lawmakers advance tax bill requiring supermajority. Raising state income taxes in Iowa would become much more difficult under legislation advanced by Republican lawmakers. Iowa Senate and House subcommittees on Tuesday advanced companion bills calling for a constitutional amendment that would require a two-thirds vote of the Iowa legislature to increase individual or corporate income taxes and to require that any individual income tax rate increase be set at a single rate for all individuals, regardless of income. Senate Study Bill 31542 and its companion House Study Bill 721 would enshrine a flat individual state income tax rate into the state's constitution by barring future legislators from reverting back to a progressive income tax with multiple brackets. What this does is decouple future tax increases from partisan votes, said Representative Bobby Kaufman, Republican from Wilton, chair of the House Tax Policy Ways and Means Committee. The constitutional amendment would need to pass two consecutive two-year general assemblies of the Iowa legislature before being put to Iowa voters for approval on the next statewide general election ballot. The earliest it could be on the ballot would be November 2026 and would need a simple majority to be enacted. Supporters, including tax policy groups, Iowa Association of Business and Industry, and Iowa Bankers Association, said the bill would provide predictability and stability in the tax code, making Iowa more attractive for investment and growth. Tyler Raegor with Americans for Prosperity called the bill's supermajority requirement a prudent safeguard against hasty and overtaxation. We think that it really strikes a perfect balance between protecting the needs of state government, but also protecting our taxpayers, Raegor said. Critics argued the bill would make it harder in the future should the need arise to raise taxes to weather financial storms or economic crisis and ensure that state is generating sufficient revenue to provide for essential services like education and health care. Mike Owen, Deputy Director of Progressive Advocacy Group Common Good Iowa, said the bill betrays democratic principles by making one no vote worth two yes votes. Raising taxes in Iowa is difficult, even if it is with a simple majority, Owen told lawmakers. The House and Senate legislation enables a one-third minority in either chamber block any increase in income or corporate income tax rates. That would take only 17 members of the Senate or 34 members of the House to stop majorities from passing a future rate increase. The restriction does not apply to increases in the sales tax or other fees and fines that tend to be borne more heavily as a share of income by lower and middle income Iowans. Owen and representatives for Interfaith Alliance of Iowa and Iowa's Catholic bishops said the legislation cements inequities into Iowa taxes by allowing only a flat rate income tax that disproportionately benefits wealthier Iowans. Common Good Iowa, based on analysis using Iowa Department of Revenue data, estimates under state income tax cuts passed in 2022, the average millionaire will see a cut of $62,000 a year when fully implemented in 2026. In the middle, Iowans earning $40,000 to $60,000 will see an average cut of $300. Most with incomes under $40,000 will see no cut at all. The nonpartisan legislative service agency estimates the tax cuts will cost $1.9 billion a year by fiscal year 2028. The eventual consequences will be cuts to services that make Iowa a good place to live, work, and raise a family, including funding for schools, health care, public safety, child care, environmental protection, according to Common Good Iowa. This is an incredible burden, especially if you have a situation where, as we believe 10 years from now, we're going to get a fiscal crisis, Owen told lawmakers. And we're going to be cutting services heavily, or that's what we're going to have to do because of the tax cut passed. People might not like that, and the person sitting in your seats will be then in a position where they cannot correct it. Tom Chapman, director of the Iowa Catholic Conference, said the group is registered opposed to the bill based on Catholic social teaching. Chapman said, which says that all members of a society have responsibility to contribute to the common good. From those to whom much has been given, much should be expected. Paying taxes is one way people give back to society. He said the Iowa Catholic Conference in particular opposes the bill because it would not permit the legislature to adopt the lower tax rate for low-income Iowans. The principles of distributed justice suggests we should have a special concern for the poor and vulnerable, Chapman told the lawmakers. Senator Jason Schultz, Republican from Schleswig, said measures would help prevent taxpayers from having their income taken away from them easily, willy-nilly, through tax increases. Jay Kiefel with Iowans for Tax Relief cited polling from the Tax Policy Group that found 68% of respondents, including Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, would support an amendment requiring a supermajority of the Iowa legislature to raise taxes, whereas 48% would support a constitutional amendment to implement a uniform income tax rate for all individuals. Representative John Willis, Republican from Spirit Lake, said, I think that it is prudent to have the guardrails on any future tax increases for the fact that with all the hard work that we've done, we don't want that hard work to be gone over a period of just a few years. We understand that our economy will sometime in the future go down. We have budgeted prudently and accordingly for that, so I'm very excited about this. Republicans note, despite the tax cuts already delivered, Iowans ended 2023 with a $1.83 billion surplus, $902 million in reserve funds, and has a $3.5 billion in the Taxpayer Relief Fund. The bills now head to the Ways and Means Committee in the House and Senate for consideration. Republican lawmakers are also pursuing separate measures that would cut Iowa's income tax rates faster than currently planned and put Iowa on a path to eliminate the individual income tax entirely. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, March 7th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now turn to the obituaries. Nancy Lynn Bartles, 86, of Hubbard, Nebraska, passed away Sunday, March 3rd. A celebration of life will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, March 9th, at Salem Lutheran Church in Dakota City. Arrangements are under the direction of Morin Becker Hunt Funeral Home in South Sioux City. Nancy was born on the daughter of Vernon and Juanita Knowles Myers on January 7, 1938, in Belleville, Illinois. Her family moved to Sioux City, where she graduated from East High School in 1955. Nancy married Roger Bartles on October 27, 1956 in Sioux City. They made their home on the family farm outside of Hubbard and enjoyed almost 67 years together. Nancy enjoyed working as an office manager bookkeeper for Bartles Ag, Bierman Brothers, Dehi, and Magic Carpet. She enjoyed singing, golfing, gardening, boating, and snow skiing. She loved to entertain and cook for her family and friends. Nancy was a longtime member of Salem Lutheran Church, where she was the choir director for over 20 years. She was also a member of the Eastern Star, Daughters of the Nile, PEO Chapter GX, and a charter member of the Craft and Culture Club of Dakota County. In lieu of flowers, donations may be directed to Salem Lutheran Church, Dakota City. The family wishes to thank the staff at Pleasant View Care Center for their excellent care of Nancy during her stay there. Therese M. Bauer, 59, of Sioux City, passed away on March 3rd at a local hospital. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. on Friday, March 8th, at Christy Smith Funeral Homes, Larkin Chapel, 2320 Outer Drive North, with the visitation taking place 1 hour prior. Therese Tressie Marie Bauer was born on July 6, 1964, to parents Charles and Alice Bauer in Sioux City. Tressie grew up in Sioux City and attended Sioux City Community Schools until her graduation. Tressie enjoyed her time working. She participated in Special Olympics and was very proud of the numerous medals and ribbons she won. In her spare time, Tressie enjoyed listening to country music. Her favorite artist was Martina McBride. Dancing, TV guides, puzzles, games, and gambling, especially slot machines. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations be made in memory of Tressie to Camp High Hopes and the Miracle League of Sioux City. John F. Cruz, age 74, of Storm Lake, died March 4th. Funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 9th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Storm Lake. Burial will be in the church cemetery. Visitation will be from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday, March 8th. Vigil will be at 7:30 p.m., all at Franske and Jensen Funeral Home in Storm Lake. Richard Dick Ernest Rutke, 85, passed Sunday. He was from Onawa. Celebration of life will be held at a later date in Onawa. Burial will be held in Graceland Cemetery, Howard, South Dakota. Gosler Funeral Home and Monuments of Onawa, Iowa are in charge of arrangements. Larry Akhus, 81, of Lawton, passed away on Saturday, March 2nd at the Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center in Sioux City. A funeral service will be held 2 p.m. Thursday, March 7th at Community Presbyterian Church of Lawton with Pastor Ken Meinsner officiating. A visitation will be held prior to the service starting at 1 p.m. at the Community Presbyterian Church of Lawton. Burial will be at Banner Township Cemetery of Lawton. The Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Mobile is in charge of the arrangements. Larry was born January 27, 1943 in Spencer, Iowa to Melvin Conrad and Vivian Florence Johnson Akhus. He was raised in Everly, Iowa and attended Everly High School, then joined the U.S. Navy and served for 4 years as gunner's mate on the USS Ranger. Upon his return to Everly, Larry was united in marriage to Linda Lee Morey on October 2, 1965. He began working as an asbestos worker. They made their home in Lawton in 1969, where the three children were born and raised. Larry started an insulation business, A&G Insulation, with his friend Malcolm Gibson. He was a lifelong member of Local 57 Heat and Frost Insulators Union. He served as a union representative for 14 years and held various offices. Larry also started a construction business with his friend Steve Sebasta and enjoyed running his antique shop in Lawton with his friend Bob Gerking. Larry was a lifelong member of the Red Wing Collector Society. In his free time, Larry enjoyed collecting antiques, stoneware, and pottery. He was a member of the Lawton Presbyterian Church, where he served as a deacon. Ace Anthony Schrunk, Missouri Valley, Iowa, died on Monday, March 4th at the Longview Nursing Home in Missouri Valley at the age of 83, 4 months and 14 days. A massive Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 8th at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Missouri Valley. Visitation will be from 5 to 6:30 p.m. Thursday with a rosary at 6:30, all at the church. Burial will be in the St. Rose of Lima Catholic Cemetery in Denison. Ace Anthony Schrunk was born on October 19, 1940 to parents Otto Francis and Frances Agnes Schrunk in Danbury, Iowa. He grew up in Danbury and attended Catholic school and graduated from Danbury High School in 1960. Ace served in the Iowa National Guard. On May 9, 1964, Ace married Mary Owens at the Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Sioux City. Ace worked as an international harvester mechanic in the Mapleton and Lamar's areas. In the early 1980s, Ace became a machinist. The family moved to Omaha in 1984, where Ace worked for Preco, Inc. Ace retired in 2006. The couple moved to Missouri Valley in 2000. Ace was a member of the St. Patrick Catholic Church in Missouri Valley. He enjoyed riding his motorcycle. He loved working outside with his Kubota tractor, his model train set complete with a tunnel, collecting 1/16th scale International Harvester tractors, and his Great Danes. You can never take the farm out of the farm boy. Most of all, he cherished his time with his wife, children, and grandchildren. Philip P. Ortman, Sioux City, 72, died March 1st in Sioux City. Funeral Mass will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 8th, at Holy Cross Parish Blessed Sacrament Church. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 7th, at Christy Smith Funeral Home's Larkin Chapel, with a prayer service at 6:30. Rhonda Sampson, 62, of Sioux City, passed away March 5th. A celebration of life will be held at 6 p.m. Monday, March 11th, with visitation beginning 1 hour prior, all at Salix United Methodist Church. Arrangements are with the Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. And that concludes the obituaries for today. We'll now turn to the devotional column written by Kathy Yolder, which is runs every Thursday. And on today, she writes, "There are many doors we walk through in life. I love the sound of an old screen door. It brings back memories from long ago, reminding me of warm summer days that seem to stretch out to eternity. It's not a door that's politely open, but one that's run through at top speed. And just as it's banging shut, a brother or sister runs through it from a different direction. To me, it represents the door to childhood. Even as we grow older, it can be a revolving door. We walk through the door to childhood again as we remember a time that went by too fast. We hear the sound of the screen door and relive those long ago times once more. There are doors that are easily walked through, like the doors of friendship. We make friends when we're young. Sometimes these friendships last a lifetime. Even if they don't last that long, their memories live on. The lessons we learn from those early friendships help us to be better friends as we grow older. There are doors of opportunity. There seem to be more of these doors when we're young and trying to decide what to do with our life. They pop up all over the place, but we can't walk through them all. We must pick and choose. As we pick one door, another one disappears. There are also doors that we don't choose to walk through. When tragedy arises, doors appear that we haven't seen before and likely have not imagined. Not all these doors are the same. Many are doors of fear, fear of the unknown, fear of what has happened or will happen. We can easily get stuck behind these doors, afraid to stay and more afraid to go. What makes all the difference is our traveling companion through these doors. In my own life, I have traveled through doors that I didn't know existed until tragedy struck. Not knowing which door to walk through, I did the only thing I could. I asked Jesus to lead the way. He did, of course. The doors he and I walked through led me to places I've never been before. I noticed a few things along the way. Once we walked through a particular door, there was no going back. That door was gone, but we encountered new doors. Jesus led me through them even though there were times I didn't feel him near. Those are the hardest times, the times we are called to simply walk by faith. It's not like running through a childhood screen door at top speed. No, it's a careful walking with prayer in each and every step. As the Lord continues to lead me over the years, I realize something else. I'm different. I have changed. There's even some transformation that has taken place. At times, my steps and his steps are very close together. He's leading, and I'm anticipating where he's taking me. Of course, there are many times when I have no idea where we're going, and even when we are at where we are at the moment. I guess that's walking by faith and not by sight. We've met others along the way. Some were going through their own doors. Others could not find a door. The Lord graciously has helped me to help others. Those have been very meaningful doors to walk through. As I was singing with the congregation in church this past Sunday, an image came to me. I've seen it before. Both times I was worshiping with my church family at the beginning of the service. I saw a large wooden door on an altar. It's obvious that it's solid wood. It's heavy, not a flimsy screen door or a hollow door. No, it's a substantial door that was carved long ago with meticulous care and skill. The door is shut tight. It's not going to accidentally open. A gust of wind isn't going to push it open. No one is going to sneakily enter through this door. I see myself running toward that door with everything I've got. I don't meander. I don't stroll. I sprint. Even though the door is shut, I know that when I reach the door, it will fly open at just the right time. Suddenly, I know what the door means. This is the door that I have been running to all my life. Why will it fly open at the right time? Because Jesus has already opened this door through his work on the cross. In fact, Jesus is the door. And then from John 10:9, I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. This is the door to eternity. I see a crack of light, and I know that behind this door is the most beautiful light that shines with a brilliance not found on earth. This is the light that lights up heaven. This is the light that shines eternally. This is the light that is Jesus. What must we do in this life? Run to the door. We run with others who believe that Jesus is the Son of God. We run with others who know and love God. We run with others who are our brothers and sisters now and for all eternity. We run to the door. We run to Jesus. And again, this was the weekly article written by Kathy Yoder, who is a devotional writer. Our next article is titled, Sioux City Born, Oscar Bound. Some of Hollywood's biggest stars will be walking down the red carpet of the Dolby Theater Sunday night when Oscars are handed out at the 96th Annual Academy Awards ceremonies. In the midst of the Coopers, the De Niros, and the Goslings will be Jordan Dykstra, a Sioux City native whose musical score is featured in 20 Days in Mariupol, a documentary which revolves around a team of Ukrainian journalists trapped in the besieged city of Mariupol when Russian troops invade Ukraine. The film, directed by Mstislav Jurnov, as part of PBS's Frontline series, was nominated in the category of Best Documentary Feature. So, how did Dykstra, a 2003 Bishop Heland Catholic High School graduate, begin writing scores for movies? It began with a lifelong love of music. He explained, I grew up in a family where music was very important. My siblings all played musical instruments, and I began playing the violin at age 4. Indeed, the now 38-year-old Dykstra spent much of his 20s on the West Coast as a professional musician. He said, I was totally into chamber music. I always liked movies, but it wasn't my focus. That all began to change when Dykstra moved to the East Coast and began accepting offers to write musical scores for both documentaries and dramatic movies. Since then, he has written scores for such films as Blow the Man Down, Hail Satan, and then 2019's Documenting Hate, which was an Emmy Award winner for Outstanding Investigative Documentary. While Dykstra has found success in creating film scores, concert music remains his passion. "I feel liberated from film music when my chamber music is performed," he said. "I see the ensemble interacting with my scores, the space interacting with the sound, and the audience interacting with both. Those moments are and always will be unattainable in the realm of cinema, which is why I will never fall on that sword entirely," he said. So we have some questions. First question, "You have written scores for both dramatic movies as well as documentaries. How do you approach writing the two very different types of films?" The answer, "The main difference in scoring narrative films and documentary films is the director's intentions. I've done a bunch of art documentaries where music plays a very subtle role, while on the other hand, some more conventional documentaries have music almost throughout. For instance, 20 Days is 94 minutes long and features 71 minutes of music." Next question, "Tell me more about 20 Days in Mariupol. What stood out about this particular project?" And the answer, "20 Days was such a tough film for me to work on. I can't stress this enough. I've never wept so much alone on the job before. I was not prepared for the impact. I muscled my way through it only to find, after a particularly intense year of scoring 20 Days, as well as an upcoming documentary called Shaken, about the bad science behind Shaken Baby Syndrome, and then inside the Uvalde response about the school shooting in Texas, that I had not properly or honestly dealt with the secondary trauma associated with working hundreds of hours with the material. I'm still working through it." And the next question, "When you were working on 20 Days, did you think it would attract so much industry buzz? I know the movie just picked up a British Academy Film Award trophy for Best Documentary of the Year a few weeks back." And the answer, "I think I can speak for the whole team in saying we knew the film was going to have an impact, but when it got into the Sundance Film Festival, we were absolutely shocked. I can assure you, receiving an Oscar, let alone being nominated for one, was not on our minds." Next question, "I know that film composers work behind the scenes. What is it like to be suddenly in front of the cameras for a change?" And the answer, "At Sundance, the 20 Days whole crew wore all black to a photo shoot. I felt a bit awkward when I showed up in a baby blue shirt." And then the last question, "Well, you know I have to finish with the inevitable pre-Oscar question. What will you be wearing on the red carpet?" "I will be wearing a responsible wolf suit as well as a beautiful off-white shirt." And our next story is about the fish fries during Lenten season. Each week, L. Metz orders 25 gallons of green beans, 40 gallons of mac and cheese, and more than 750 6-ounce pieces of filet of cod. Is he going to feed an army? No, Metz is simply the go-to person at the Holy Cross Famous Fish Dinner, held from 4:30 to 6:30 every Friday during Lent at the St. Michael Catholic Parish at 2223 Indian Hills Drive. With more than 40 years of experience as kitchen manager for Hy-Vee, Metz is clearly the right person for the job. "I'm the guy who is nervously attending to every minor detail," the Bloomington, Minnesota native explained with one eye on the clock. "If I do my job well, my crew can do their job easily while feeding upward of 700 people over the course of the next 2 hours." Indeed, Metz and his kitchen helpers have their system down pat, with prep beginning shortly after noon each Friday. By 3 p.m., each piece is hand-breaded with a special seasoning before it is given a deep-fried dunk. Bags and bags of au gratin potatoes are soaked in a bath of butter and milk in pans prior to a trip into the oven. Containers of gooey mac and cheese are then heated up in oversized pots on burners inside of the parish center's professional quality kitchen. In an adjacent area, church women slice up a seemingly never-ending assortment of cakes, pies, brownies, and bars that have been handmade by Holy Cross parishioners. "We have a set menu of fish, au gratin potatoes, mac and cheese, a takeout orders were a holdover from COVID years," Metz said. "We've extended it because it proved to be so popular." Beyond the food, fish fries are a time for people to socialize. Nothing brings people together better than good food and good conversation, Matt said. We have plenty of both every Friday night. Even better, you don't have to be a Catholic to grab a plate at the Holy Cross fish dinner. We serve Lutheran, Methodist, you name it, Matt said. Nobody is ever turned away. In fact, everyone is dazzled and well-fed by this phenomenal fish fry feed. There is something really special about a fish fry during the season of Lent, Metz explained. You come for the food and then stick around for the fellowship. Anything else? Well, you can't forget about the desserts, he added. Our parishioners' desserts are just as memorable as the fish. We'll now move to Dear Abby and the letter. I have four sisters. I have felt like the odd one out my entire life, and they know it. They gossip about me and my children at every opportunity. They are all financially well off. I am not. They take trips and get together frequently, but don't include me because they think I cannot afford it. When I have made my feelings known, they say I am too sensitive and a drama queen. I told them they don't have the right to look down on me and judge. How can I get them to stop being so superior and accept me and my children? I have been a widow for 5 years after a long and abusive marriage. They accuse me of exaggerating the mental and emotional abuse I experienced. How can I make them understand? Signed, Excluded Sis in Nebraska. And Abby's reply, you wrote that you have felt like the odd one out your entire life and your sisters know it. You also stated that they travel together without including you because they think you can't afford it. If that's true, do you think they should have paid your fare? If you do, it's presumptuous. After a long and abusive marriage, you must feel like you have been let out of jail. For your sisters to dismiss what you experience as exaggeration is insensitive and cruel. Because you aren't going to change them, eliminate them from your life. They may be unwilling or unable to give you the inclusion and acceptance you seek from them. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, March 7th. I'm Dagna, your reader. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors describe the increased risk as modest, but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. Chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.